We stopped last time talking about the fact that the way DNA replication works is via a semi-conservative model, meaning one strand is original and a brand new strand is made using that old strand as a template. Now it's time to look at the particulars of the process, starting with slide 12, which is an overview of how it happens in each of the two kinds of cells in the cell dichotomy. You have a prokaryotic cell on the top, or the DNA from a cell, and from a eukaryotic cell on the bottom. Recall that as far as the DNA is concerned, the difference between prokaryotic and eukaryotic cells is that a prokaryotic cell typically has just one chromosome, whereas a eukaryotic cell has some number that depends on the species. And also, a prokaryotic chromosome is circular, makes a loop so it doesn't have any ends, whereas each individual eukaryotic chromosome is linear, has two ends. And that makes a little bit of a difference in how this occurs, although it's really the same process. Let's look at the prokaryotic example at the top. So you have a double-stranded circular DNA. Now, actually, it is a double helix, like we've already talked about. They just don't show it that way. So it's you have to imagine a spiral staircase all the way around the circles, how it really would be, but that just makes it hard to look at. So they simplified it by showing it as two circles. But remember how the textbook that this is from uses the color coding. The dark blue means that's the original DNA. Light blue means a new strand that's being built. So anyway, a circular chromosome, like you find in a prokaryote, doesn't have any end, of course. But there is a particular place along that circle where replication begins. It's not just randomly started somewhere along the circle. It's at a specific place represented by these two black dots that are called, descriptively enough, the origin of replication, where replication originates. And that gets recognized. Now, it's all a DNA sequence, but the origin of replication is a specific subsequence that the cell recognizes as the starting place. And to get replication going, you have to first separate the two strands. I was talking about this last time. To do either of the two jobs of DNA, whether it's replication, what we're looking at here, or transcription, next chapter, you have to read the code. And to do that, you need to separate the two strands from each other. That separation occurs in a prokaryote at the origin of replication, somewhere in the circle. And separating the two strands from each other forms what is called a replication bubble, which is this football-shaped thing, you know, two points, just like a football. Those points, by the way, are called replication forks, because that's the place where the unzipping is occurring. And as you unzip it more, and unzip it more at the other replication fork at the other end of the bubble gets bigger and bigger. You can see a real bubble here. These are the two replication forks. The separation of those two strands allows the code, which is the sequence, in each strand to be read. And that tells the cell how to make a new strand that is complementary to the template strand, the strand that's being read. That's the new stuff here is the light blue material. And as that gets built, the new strand is getting longer and longer. And as the replication fork gets more and more opened up, that allows for more and more new strand to be built. And eventually, the replication bubble gets so big it gets all the way to the other side of the circular DNA. And at that point, you then are complete. You have two double-stranded DNAs, each of which is one strand original material, one strand new material. That's the semi-conservative aspect. And these two double-stranded circular chromosomes are identical to each other. Plus, they're both identical to the original one you started with, which is exactly what's required for for successful cell division, right? For a successful cell division, I mean cell division in which the two cells that result can live. For each of those two cells to live, they both have to have all of the DNA that the original cell had. And the only way that's possible is if, before dividing, the cell makes an exact copy of all the DNA it has so it can give each of the two cells a full copy. That's how it happens in a prokaryotic cell. But it's more or less the same in a eukaryotic cell, except we're not talking about a single replication bubble forming. So remember that a eukaryotic chromosome, and this is only one of however many chromosomes, the same thing is happening in the other chromosomes, but a single chromosome in a eukaryotic cell is linear. Not only that, though, it's also, in terms of number of nucleotides, how many A's, C's, T's, and G's there are in the overall sequence, it's much bigger than a prokaryotic cell. There's a lot more DNA nucleotides. So the fact that it's linear is not really a big deal. If you think about it, you could do pretty much what the prokaryotic cell does, meaning you could have the origin of replication right in the middle of however long it is, and then separate it, and the bubble would get bigger and bigger until you finally get the forks all the way to the end, right? And then you'd be done. That would work. But since there's so much more length compared to a prokaryotic cell, it's going to take quite a bit more time to do that compared to how it happens in a prokaryotic cell. So eukaryotic cells cut down that time drastically by, instead of having one replication bubble, they have several replication bubbles that simultaneously form, and each bubble has its own origin of replication. Okay? And that way, since they all are forming at once and they're all growing, they basically are, as they grow, are getting closer and closer to each other. So you only have to open up each replication bubble until it runs into the next bubble. And that gets the job done in a lot less time. Namely, one nth, however, n being the number of replication bubbles that it would take compared to if you only made one bubble. The end result is exactly the same as the end result for a prokaryote, though. You have two double-stranded DNAs. Each one is semi-conservative because each one has one original strand and one new strand. They are identical to each other, and they're both identical to the one you started with. So it accomplishes the same thing in both kinds of cells. All right, now let's look at the molecular detail of all this, starting in 13. DNA replication involves the help of several important proteins that I'm going to give you the names of, almost all of which are specifically acting as enzymes. All enzymes are proteins, but not all proteins are enzymes. So I said almost all. There's one exception to this. One of these proteins is not actually being a catalyst. But first let's see what we're looking at here. This is, notice the dark blue, this is the original DNA before any replication has occurred. And we're looking at just part of a replication bubble. One replication bubble has two replication forks, the points of the football. This is just one of those points. So the bubble, the other half of the bubble would be off the screen to the right, and there will be another replication fork over here. But the process has already started, meaning that the origin of replication, which is basically here, has already been recognized by the first of the proteins that I'll talk about, which is helicase, the green one in the cartoon. You can obviously tell it's an enzyme because it ends in ASE. Helicase is named for the fact that it separates the two strands that make up the double helix. So helicase not only recognizes the specific sequence that we're calling the origin of replication, but it also then is able to break those hydrogen bonds between the two strands. Remember, that's what's holding the two strands together. Hydrogen bonds are easy to break, and that's important. We talked about this last time. You don't want the two strands to be held together very tightly, because then it would be difficult to open them up, which is required to read the code. So there's actually two helicases working here, only one of which is shown. The other one would be on the other strand moving toward the right. But this is showing you helicase's unzipping function. It not only separates the two strands, but it continues to separate them more and more, unzipping them at each fork. All right. So this helicase is unzipping it toward the left. That's an important function, of course, because in order to build the new strand, you have to have the strands separated from each other. But helicase moves. It doesn't just separate them and stay there. It separates them and then moves to keep unzipping it. So if helicase separates the two strands and then gets out of the way, what would happen? What would you expect to happen after you have separated two complementary strands and then leave? They're going to come right back together because they're still complementary. So they match up perfectly. They're going to seal back up for the same reason they are attached to begin with, right? They match up. They're complementary. Therefore, you need the help of the second protein that I'll talk about, which are these gray ones, and there's several copies. And these are the ones that are proteins but not acting as enzymes. They are called single-strand binding proteins, which act more or less like little clamps. After helicase unzips to separate the strands, single-strand binding proteins will bind to each of the two strands, keeping them from going right back together, which would undo what helicase just accomplished. Okay, so it keeps the two strands separated long enough for then the third important protein here, which is the pink one, to do its job. This pink one is called primase, notice. And it's named for the fact that it produces what is called a primer. A primer is something that gets a process going, like priming a pump, for instance. Well, here it's important to point out something that's interesting about building polynucleotides, which are strands of nucleotides hooked together, right? Well, the goal here of DNA replication is to make a new strand of DNA nucleotides. In other words, a DNA polynucleotide. But the problem here is that cells don't have the ability to start out with DNA as the first nucleotide. Cells can add DNA nucleotides one by one to a sequence of nucleotides that are already there, but they can't have DNA be laid down onto nothing. It has to be added to something that's already there. On the other hand, cells can start by laying down RNA, even though RNA is not really what you want. Cells don't have a way around this. So that's why this primer is an RNA primer. It's not made out of DNA nucleotides, it's made out of RNA nucleotides. That's the red thing. And the enzyme that helps to produce that is primase. All right, so that's the very beginning. The primer is the very beginning of the new strand that's being built. But we're going to have to deal with later with the fact that it's really not the right stuff. It's DNA. It's RNA instead of DNA. All right, now the other important thing about the primer, or actually about any sequence of nucleotides in general, including a single nucleotide, is that there's that polarity we talked about, right? There's a 5' end and a 3' end for any sequence of nucleotides, one or more. and they're labeled here 5', 3'. The important thing to know about building a polynucleotide as far as this 3', 5', and 5' ends are concerned is that cells can add new nucleotides only to the 3' end of a strand, not to the 5' end. And therefore, where the 3' end is determines which direction this strand is going to have to grow in. That's why you have this black arrow showing that this primer, which can be elongated now by adding DNA nucleotides to it, it's going to have to grow in toward the left in this picture, in the 3' direction. Okay? We'll talk about this a little bit more in another picture, but keep that in mind. Another thing that we haven't mentioned from this slide is another important protein, the blue one here, which as you can see is called topoisomerase. This one's an enzyme as well. They're all enzymes except single-strand binding protein. But topoisomerase solves a problem that arises when helicase continues to do its job. Helicase is unzipping this thing more and more, but even though we don't see the helix is there. It's just twisted along its length. All right? So, by analogy, imagine a rope. Now, most ropes have more than two strands in them, but you can imagine a two-stranded rope, right? Just a braid of two strands. And if you had that connected to the wall, for instance, so that you could pull on it, and you're at the other end, if you want to separate those two strands in the rope, it would be fairly easy to start that process at first, right? But the more you pull them apart, what's going to happen?
Twists are getting tighter.
Right. It's going to make the twists tighter and tighter upstream of where you're separating it. And the same thing is true as helicase unzips this more and more. The winding down here is going to get more and more overwhelmed. And that's going to eventually, if it weren't for this topoisomerase enzyme, it would get wound so tight that helicase couldn't continue doing its job. It would get stuck. So as overwinding tension builds up, every now and then topoisomerase comes along and cuts the DNA, more or less lets it flop around to get loose again, and then seals it back up so that helicase can continue to unzip it till it finally gets to the end of the eukaryotic chromosome. Okay, that is most of the players in the game, but not all. Now let's go to 14. Here we're looking at the process that's already been started. So once again, the dark blue is the original stuff. This is the strand that's being read. The code is being read so that you can determine what the corresponding complementary sequence needs to be in the light blue one that you're building. And some have already been added. Notice that this is the 3' end of the new strand, which is the only end you can add new ones to, as I was saying before. 5' is where you started. Well, this next dark blue original nucleotide is an A, so by complementarity rules, that means you need to bring in a T, right? A is always with T, C is always with G. If you consider what the strand is, it's a polynucleotide, as we've discussed, right? It's a sequence of nucleotides hooked together to make up the sugar phosphate backbone, which is the light blue shading here. But each individual nucleotide that's part of this polynucleotide is, well, let me say that nucleotide, the word nucleotide, remember, is ambiguous. All nucleotide tells you is that you have a nitrogenous base, a sugar, and some number of phosphates. The word doesn't tell you how many. I talked about this in an earlier chapter, which is why it's more ATP, for instance, which is another nucleotide. It just uses ribose instead of deoxyribose. But ATP is a nucleotide. It doesn't tell you how many there are, though, how many phosphates there are. So it's more descriptive to call ATP a nucleoside triphosphate, because the nucleoside is just the nitrogenous base and the sugar, and then the triphosphate word tells you specifically there are three phosphates. But the nucleotides that are part of the growing strand, each one is individually a nucleoside monophosphate, because it contains, each one contains one phosphate, right? In other words, nucleoside monophosphates are what need to be in the final product. But notice that what's coming in here is not a nucleoside monophosphate. It's a nucleoside triphosphate. Now, why would a cell do this? If it needs to have this thymine-containing nucleotide have just one phosphate in the final product, why is it bringing it in with two phosphates? I mean, with three phosphates, two additional phosphates. Well, think about what's happening here. We're building a polynucleotide. How would you describe that process?
Anabolic.
And in energetic terms, how would you describe it?
Endergonic.
Anabolic, which means building things up, is expensive. And therefore, this is an endergonic process. You have to supply energy to do this. Well, what's the big deal we made about ATP in Unit 3?
There's a lot of energy contained in those phosphate bonds.
Right. That's why ATP is used as an energy currency. Similarly, all of these raw materials, nucleoside triphosphates, that are going to be incorporated as nucleotides in the strand are carrying a bunch of energy because of those extra two phosphates. And when you use an ATP, for instance, what you're really doing is cleaving off phosphate, right, to release energy. Well, when you cleave off the two phosphates that are extra, so that you're left with just one for the final product, that releases a lot of energy, and that energy is what allows for this anabolic, endergonic building of the strand to happen. It wouldn't happen if you just brought in a nucleoside monophosphate, because there wouldn't be any energy available to do this. You following me on this? Okay, so this happens, this elongation of the new strand happens with the help of the next major protein we're going to talk about, which is the one named in the orange box, DNA polymerase. That actually is a family of enzymes. There's different versions of them, and the specific DNA polymerase that's working here in this part is called DNA polymerase 3, Roman numeral 3. Well, obviously that's an enzyme because of its name, but even if it were named something without an ASE ending, you should be able to tell from how it's portrayed here that it's an enzyme. What am I talking about? How else can you tell besides the name that this is an enzyme?
I want to say that it's like catalyzing a process, but I don't know if I can really tell.
Well, it is true that it is, yes, that's what enzymes do, but how you can tell by looking at this, other than its name, is that it's written not on either end of the arrow, which reactants and products are, right? A catalyst is always written above or below the arrow to indicate that it's not a reactant or a product, it's just helping out. So DNA polymerase is named for the fact that it's accomplishing polymerization, which means creation of a polymer. You're making a polymer, which is the polynucleotide, by hooking together nucleotides, the monomers. And one thing it does in this process is, well, there's two major things that it does. DNA polymerase is able to read the code, so it sees the A here and notices that it's calling for a T, brings in a T-based nucleoside triphosphate, and DNA polymerase 3 cleaves off two of those phosphates to release the energy that I was talking about, and that allows for this additional covalent bond to be made, elongating the nucleotide by one, the polynucleotide by one nucleotide. And the two phosphates that get cleaved off are still one piece at first. They're inorganic because they're no longer connected to a carbon skeleton. But two phosphates hooked together are called pyrophosphate. Well, that doesn't last very long as pyrophosphate, actually. Shortly thereafter, the two phosphates hooked together unhook, and they individually are inorganic phosphates that are just part of the phosphate pool. Right, but the energy has been put into elongating the strand by one nucleotide. All right, 15. Here we're looking at, in the yellow box above, one replication bubble. Remember that one replication bubble has two replication forks. And you separated two strands, so there's two original dark blue strands that are being read, and two brand new strands, light blue, that are being produced. But it's really happening as four partial strands. They'll eventually be sewn together. But you have two categories of strands being produced here, which are called leading strands, and this is one, is shown in the box. And then diagonally on the bubble is the other leading strand. And then on the other diagonal are called lagging strands. Now, lagging means falling behind. So the lagging strands take a little bit longer to build. And this is because of this complication that comes up about what I've already told you is true in as far as elongating polynucleotides is concerned. A cell can add new nucleotides only to the 3' end. So every fragment that's being built here has to grow in the 3' direction, right? Whether it's lagging or leading strand, has to grow in the 3' direction. But the reason the leading strand works easier and is faster to build is that the 3' direction for the leading strand, which is to the left on this top one, and the other leading strand is toward the right, but in both cases it's toward the 3' end. The 3' end for the leading strand is in the direction in which the fork is opening up. Okay? Which makes it nice, because you just lay down the primer, one primer for a leading strand, and then you start adding DNA nucleotides one by one, and as the fork opens up more and more, it's opening up in the right direction for this to just continue growing. The lagging strands have a problem, though. They also have to grow in the 3' direction, but for them, because of the anti-parallel relationship of the two strands, 3' is in the direction opposite compared to how the fork is opening up. So you have to build a lagging strand piecewise. You have to open up by unzipping enough to lay down a primer, and this one would have been first, and then grow it in the opposite direction. Then you open it up more, lay down a new primer, and then grow it in the 3' direction until you hit the previous primer, and keep doing that. All right? Because it's because the fork is opening up in the wrong direction compared to the direction of growth. And each of those little fragments are named after a scientist. They are called Okazaki fragments. So each lagging strand consists of several Okazaki fragments. Each fragment requires its own RNA primer. Each leading strand requires only one primer and grows as long as the fork keeps opening up. All right? Now, on the cartoon in the middle, we can see here that the primer for the leading strand, which is right here is where we are on the top, has already been laid down by primase, the enzyme primase, that was the pink one. This orange one is DNA polymerase 3. So it's the first time we're seeing it in cartoon form. It's the one that was just in the box, its name, in the previous slide. Okay, that's the DNA polymerase 3 is the one that elongates it by adding DNA nucleotides to the primer. So put the first DNA down, then the next DNA, and so on, one nucleotide at a time. And this one's growing in the 3' direction, which is nice because this fork is opening up, allowing it to continue in that direction. That's why it's the leading strand. Okay, and the once again, the gray ones are they keep moving as helicase moves. The green one is helicase, it's unzipping it further. The gray ones are the single-strand binding proteins, keeping the two strands from sealing back up long enough for DNA polymerase 3 to come along and do its job of elongation. Really, not any new information. I've already explained the problem with the lagging strands. This is just showing you with numbers that the fragments are growing in the opposite direction compared to how the fork is opening. So this number one had to be built first, and that would have been when the fork hadn't even opened up this area yet. Then you helicase opens the fork more, and that gives you room to lay down a new primer and start building this one in the 3' direction until you run into the previous fragment, and so on as it keeps opening up. Each of those little ones are Okazaki fragments. And the Okazaki fragments, once they are sewn together, which I'll talk about in a minute, will make up a lagging strand. So one lagging strand is several Okazaki fragments big. And you have a different lagging strand diagonally for the same reason. This one's opening up also in the opposite direction. The 3' for this one is toward the left. 17 shows you these Okazaki fragments being built. And so this really isn't any new information either. Every RNA primer, which I said is one per leading strand and one per Okazaki fragment, but every one has to be built the same way, namely with the help of the pink enzyme here, which is primase. All right? That primer itself has a 3' end, and that's the only end you can add DNA nucleotides to, but that's the job of the orange one, which is DNA polymerase 3. But eventually, you'll get to the point where you run into the previously already laid down primer from the previous Okazaki fragment. And that's when DNA polymerase 3's job is done. Okay, now we've talked about most of the proteins involved here, but if those are the only ones working, then we can't complete the job. Because even when you get to the point where all the spaces are filled, the spaces meaning you've laid down all the nucleotides, you're not done for a couple reasons. One is that you have to deal with the fact that this is not pure DNA yet, right? So every RNA primer, which was necessary, now has to be dealt with because it's the wrong stuff. You had to use it, but now you need to replace it. And that involves still another important protein, which is called DNA polymerase 1. That's the yellow one. Okay? So this red primer right by the yellow enzyme, DNA polymerase 1, used to be longer. What DNA polymerase 1 is able to do once all the nucleotides are in place, once all the holes are filled, DNA polymerase 1 goes along and recognizes the RNA primers. And it's able to remove those nucleotides one at a time and replace them with DNA. The reason that it's able to replace them with DNA is because now you have something on the other side to add DNA to. You're not adding it down to nothing. Okay, so that accomplishes one of the problems that remains. You've gotten rid of the RNA. But the job is still not complete because DNA polymerase 1 is able to replace all of those nucleotides, but every time it gets rid of the last nucleotide, red nucleotide in a primer, and puts down a blue one, it's not able to connect that blue one with the blue one right next to it. There's a little nick. So instead of having one continuous strand, it's all DNA at this point, but instead of it being one continuous strand, it has a bunch of little nicks in it, where you need to make the final covalent bonds between sugar and phosphate to complete the backbone. And that requires the last of the major proteins that I'm talking about, which in this case is this bluish one on the bottom. And that is called DNA ligase. Now, it gets that name because ligate, the verb, means to tie or to bind. So to ligate, that's why you have, in surgery, for instance, you have ligatures, which are tied. Ligase ligates or forms bonds between these two DNA nucleotides where there's a nick. And there will be several nicks because there are many different primers that had to be built, each of which leaves a nick. Once that's done, then, you have one continuous DNA strand, and it is complementary to the dark blue original DNA strand that was being read as a code for how to build the new one. Okay, so 18 really just reviews this whole process with all of these major players, except for topoisomerase. It's not shown in this picture, but it's still doing its job. Let's just quickly go through it as a review. The origin of replication is recognized by helicase, which separates the two strands and then starts unzipping. At one helicase unzips one replication fork on one end of the bubble. Another helicase does the same thing at the other replication fork. Single-strand binding proteins, the gray one, come along and clamp onto each single strand so that, to keep them from just sealing right back up as soon as helicase leaves. And that allows enough time for primase to come along, the pink one. It did it originally up here on the leading strand. There's many copies of primase. Primase does the job of laying down a short sequence of RNA nucleotides known as a primer. That has something in place then so that the next enzyme, DNA polymerase 3, can come along and add DNA nucleotides in the 3' end of this growing strand, starting with the primer and then adding DNA one at a time. And there's only one primer for the leading strand, as I talked about. There are several primers for the lagging strand, one primer per Okazaki fragment, but it still uses the same enzymes. And then after all the nucleotides have been added, you have to get rid of the RNA of the primers, and that's the job of DNA polymerase 1. But it can't sew that last DNA to the previous DNA, so it leaves a little nick, and that is taken care of by DNA ligase, sewing all the bits together, all the Okazaki fragments, plus all the various leading strands, two per bubble, until you're done. All right, that's how things normally work. And it's actually quite impressive how few mistakes are made in this process, because one chromosome contains millions of nucleotides. Just using humans as an example, that's just one of 23 chromosomes. So there's many, many millions in one cell out of 100 trillion in your body. So if you compare this to an industrial process, you know, like if you make one mistake in 1 million, you are doing a hell of a job as an industry. It's hard to have that high a success rate. But think about that in terms of DNA replication. Even one error in 1 million means you're going to have several errors for every chromosome that you try to replicate, right? Because there's many millions of nucleotides. So there are errors that are made, but it's already impressively few errors that get made to begin with. And then that's made even better by the fact that cells have what are called proofreading mechanisms. to recognize errors that were made and fix them before they can do anything weird. Here we have a nuclease enzyme, and that's a kind of a generic term. There's many different kinds of nucleases. But nucleases are enzymes that are able to take or to break a nucleic acid, which is a polynucleotide, into bits. In other words, it breaks bonds between nucleotides in a strand. And nucleases are part of this proofreading mechanism. Now, what we see here on the top is an error, not really an error of sequence. This happens pretty easily by exposure to sunlight, what we're looking at here. See the little bow in this top strand? This happens particularly easily when you have two thymines next to each other. Remember, the sequence of one strand can be anything. It happens pretty often that in a sequence you have two T's next to each other. And two thymines next to each other are pretty susceptible to damage by ultraviolet radiation, which is in sunlight, right? This is part of why it causes cancer. When ultraviolet strikes where these two thymines are, it causes them to covalently bond to each other. The two thymines are the nitrogenous bases, right? Remember what I said about the nitrogenous bases. They are not holding the strand together at all. They're not hooked to each other. They're just individually hanging off the sugar phosphate backbone. But two thymines can be erroneously covalently bonded to each other with the help of UV. And that's called a thymine-thymine dimer, a two-parter. Well, that causes malfunction of the DNA, so it's a problem. Well, this nuclease in green is able to go along these DNA strands and notice these. So it recognizes that this is the problem, and it undergoes, the enzyme causes what's called excision repair. To excise means to cut out. Just like in scissors means cut and X means out. Excision repair involves nuclease recognizing where the problem is, making two cuts, one on either side of the problem, in one strand, and removing those nucleotides. And it's not a problem to remove those. You're not going to lose any information. Why? Why should the cell not be concerned that it's removing these nucleotides? The information is still there in the form of the other strand, right? So you have this hole, but you know how to fill it because you read the other strand that's still there, and by complementarity rules, it tells you exactly which ones to replace it with. Well, nuclease does the cutting, and then DNA polymerase 1, which is the yellow one again, is doing its job again, which is to lay down nucleotides to complete this excision repair. And then it's not going to be able to make this final covalent bond, so once again you need DNA ligase to complete it. And now this is completely repaired DNA. It's as though the problem never happened to begin with. But like I said, it really doesn't happen all that often anyway. In 20, we're looking at a problem that exists only for eukaryotic organisms. And that's because of what I've already said about prokaryotic DNA. The chromosome in a prokaryotic cell is circular, so there aren't any ends. They don't have this problem that we're looking at. But a eukaryotic chromosome has two ends, and there's a problem at each of those two ends, even though we're only looking at one end. The other end is way off to the right edge, but it will have the same problem. And the problem has to do with this fact that you can't lay DNA down onto nothing. You can only add it to a strand that's already there, to the 3' end of a strand that's already there. Okay? So notice we have a primer and a primer, but this left primer is right at the end of the strand. This one's not right at the end. And all the other primers, however many they are, they wouldn't be at the end either. So what did I say is the enzyme responsible for recognizing and removing the primers? DNA polymerase 1, the yellow one, comes along and it can remove all the primers, including this one on the end. Okay? But look at this right primer here. When DNA polymerase comes along and removes these RNA nucleotides, it can replace them with DNA because this little stretch of DNA exists and it can just build onto it. But when it removes the RNA nucleotides of this primer right at the end, it can't replace them with DNA because there isn't any DNA right here to add to. You see what I'm saying here? And therefore, it removes it but leaves it empty at the end. Only in eukaryotic cells, because only eukaryotic chromosomes have ends. They're linear chromosomes. So what this means is that in DNA replication in a eukaryote, the new strand is a little bit shorter than the original strand. And each generation, each cell cycle, the DNA would get a little bit shorter. Well, eventually that would be a problem, right? We haven't talked much about genes yet, but a gene is really just a subsequence of the overall very long sequence of C's, T's, A's, and G's that the whole DNA is. And genes are the most important part of the DNA, but they are just a sequence within a longer sequence. And they're spaced apart with sequences in between them that aren't genes. Those sequences between the genes are called non-coding sequences because they're not coding for how to build anything. And it might surprise you that the genes are really only about, it's actually less than 1% of the overall DNA. It's mostly non-coding regions, including non-coding regions at the end. So if you make a little bit shorter DNA each cell cycle, it's not immediately a big deal because you're removing sequences that aren't coding for anything anyway. You're not eating into a gene, in other words. But if you make it shorter every cell cycle, eventually you will be eating into the genes. I usually use the analogy of motion picture film, even though now it's all digital, but you're familiar with frames on film, right? And if you use actual film to project the movie, you have to load it into the projector, and you have to have some leader, as it's called, which is film but without any actual frames on it, no images. It's just a length that allows you to get it strung into the machine until eventually it gets to the first frame of the movie. That first frame of the movie is like the first gene on a DNA. And if it's a popular movie shown very often, then the projectionist has to do this many times. And eventually the leader gets frayed and it won't load properly. So the way to do that is to just cut off the end a little bit. Gives you a nice fresh edge to load into the projector. That's kind of what's happening here with the DNA. It's getting a little bit shorter each time. That's not a problem for the film unless you use it so many times that you run out of leader and eventually you would then be cutting off frames of the movie. So that would be a problem because you need all of your genes since they code for how to build the proteins that you require to live. Well, although this is a problem, eukaryotic cells have evolved way around this problem. And that is by having enzymes, special enzymes that are called telomerases. this is named for a telomere. Remember we talked about a centromere, which is the place along the length of a replicated chromosome where the two chromatids are joined? Telomeres, telo meaning far, are the tips. So the ends of a DNA are called telomeres. And that's where the problems are, because that's where it has to get shorter. Well, telomerase is a special enzyme that puts on an extended leader, so to speak. It just puts on some DNA nucleotides that have no meaning as a code. They just make it longer so that when you then undergo DNA replication in the next cell cycle, it will get shorter, but you're just cutting off something you added as leader material. And therefore, it doesn't ever eat into the genes. So we have those. We eukaryotes do, but not prokaryotes. There's two slides left in this show, 21 and 22, but they actually, if you were looking at this in a book that it came from, they're the same picture. So notice 21 and 22, if you stacked them next to each other, they would make one continuous shot. What we're looking at in this shot is the organization of DNA along with proteins that makes up chromatin. Remember, we talked about the fact that chromatin is one enormously long DNA, double helix, plus a bunch of proteins complexed with it. And those proteins individually are called histones. That's what the purple things are. And the reason that the histones are important, well, there's more than one reason, but one big reason is so that you can manage this enormous length of DNA and package it compactly into an invisible cell. Didn't you do a calculation last lab about how much total length of DNA there is in the body? And if you use all of your cells, your 100 trillion cells or so, it is roughly 2,000 times, just one human, has DNA, if you stretched it out, the length would equal about 2,000 times the distance from the Earth to the Sun. That is ridiculously long. And it's all fit into the cells of your body because of how it's packaged with these histone proteins. So as we proceed through this whole two-slide picture from left to right, we're zooming out. Here we're zoomed in close on the DNA, and that's all we're seeing is the DNA at this end. Right? That's the double helix. And then you can see it looks like it's smaller and smaller because we're zooming out. Individual histone proteins, each purple thing, is shaped kind of like a sperm, a globular head and a tail. All right. If you take 8 of these histones, each identical, and you arrange them in this way, 2 sets of 4 with their tails radiating outward, then you make a shape that acts just like a hose reel for a garden hose. And that allows you to wrap some of the length of the DNA around one of these hose reels made up of 8 histones. Okay, now that is called a nucleosome. A nucleosome is 8 histone proteins forming a reel or a spool and some length of DNA wrapped around it. Well, there's many, many nucleosomes. And when you look at them, like in the photomicrograph here, while they're still not condensed, the nucleosomes look like little beads on a string. With the string between each bead, between each nucleosome, is simply DNA that's not wrapped around anything. It's going from one spool to the next. Now, doing that by itself drastically reduces the overall length of the DNA, right? Because you've wrapped it around all these spools. But as we zoom out, we can see that once these nucleosomes are formed, each one like a spool, then they clump together. The nucleosomes clump together to make this much thicker filament compared to just a single, the DNA by itself. And that's the right edge. And that clumping together makes it much more compact. And then when we continue toward the right in slide 22, we can see that this thicker fiber then gets looped back and forth many times to make a much thicker fiber, which is how it's packaged as condensed chromatin in this overall replicated chromosome that we see. So there's an enormously long DNA just in that one chromosome. There's, for humans, 22 others just in that one cell, and then you have 100 trillion cells in your body each having all of those chromosomes. That is the chapter. So I just want to start a little bit of the next one.